Today's program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit Kane5.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Short and hot with Chef Family.
Short and hot with Chef Family.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson. I am not at Roberta's today, but I have a brand new show for you. First New York Times bestselling author Emma Straub talks about her newest novel, The Vacationers. And after the break, Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch and Four Fish, and I talk about oysters and New York Harbor. A big thanks to our official coffee sponsor, Craft Coffee. Hit up their website, pick a subscription that works for you, and have delicious handcrafted artisanal coffee delivered right to your door every month. It is a special treat on weekend mornings for us, and one less thing I have to think about or research, as they have done all the work for me. Use code SHARP at checkout and get 10% off of your order. Okay, first up, Miss Emma Straub.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for coming on Sharp and Hot.
Sure. Am I talking to you in the trailer outside of Roberta's?
You are not. You are talking to me in my living room / dining room in New Jersey.
Oh, well, that sounds good, but maybe, I don't know, maybe you don't have pizza. Maybe you do have pizza.
I don't currently have any pizza, but I do have pizza almost every Tuesday when I'm out there doing the show live.
Okay.
So you're familiar with Roberta's?
I am, yes. I haven't exactly been on Heritage Radio before, but I'm friends with Michael Harlan Turkell, who has a show called Food Scene, and he had my husband on once, and I was in the trailer while they were taping it, so I've been to the site.
Awesome. Yeah, Michael's show airs directly after mine. I see Michael every Tuesday. Yeah.
Oh, how cute.
So you have published this book called The Vacationers. It's your third novel, correct?
Yes.
So
it's my second novel. It's my third book. I have a story collection and then two novels.
Oh, it's a story collection. Okay, I apologize.
That's right.
Can you set up the story of The Vacationers for my listeners?
Of course. So The Vacationers is about a family from New York City on a two-week vacation in Mallorca, Spain. There's Franny and Jim, who have been married for 35 years. Their 18-year-old daughter, Sylvia, who has just graduated from high school. Her 28-year-old or older brother, who sells real estate in Miami. His significantly older girlfriend, Carmen, and then Franny's best friend, Charles, and his husband, Lawrence. And they are all sort of marooned in this beautiful house together in Mallorca, Spain.
And they plan this vacation early in the year, like in February, right? Franny and Jim do sort of to celebrate Sylvia's birthday and departure from home, and then their family sort of implodes before takeoff.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the kind of thing where, like, if they hadn't planned it so many months in advance, then this trip would definitely have been canceled. But it's too late to cancel, and so they're going. Franny and Jim are having a rough time in their marriage. Bobby is having some financial problems. Everybody's got problems.
Right.
Everybody's got problems.
And they're all in this house together. And one of the things that I found was that their food and their eating is almost a character itself in the book. And Franny is a food writer, right?
Yeah, yes, yes. And that, I mean, I was thinking a lot about the food in the book because Franny is a food writer and a travel writer. And so I knew that they had to go somewhere where the food would be really good. And not only would the food be really good, but it would have to be food that I was going to get excited about writing. And, you know, what's better than cheese and things like that. Spain does things right.
Right.
I was pretty excited about going to Spain and eating my way across in way of research.
And you did do that, and you described these pastries that are shaped like seashells. Are those specific to Mallorca?
Yes, they are. It's sort of the local delicacy. They're called ensaimadas, and they're a little bit like palmiers, you know, like the elephant ears.
Right.
They're a little bit like that, but less. It's less crusty pastry. It's a little bit softer, and there's a lot of powdered sugar, and they are really, really delicious.
Like the way you write about them, my mouth was watering. It's like, I want to go there and eat that.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere you can get them
too.
In New York?
Sorry?
Have you found them in New York?
Oh, no, I haven't. I need to start frequenting more Spanish restaurants, because they must have them somewhere.
I imagine someone
misses
them. But no,
I have not found them yet.
And there's another scene where Franny and Charles go to a grocery store, and I've done that so many times, to go to a foreign grocery store and just kind of admire everything that's so different in a foreign place. Is that something you enjoy doing in real life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Always. And I mean, I am by no means a gourmet. I'm not a very good cook. I do like to bake, but, you know, I have very few tricks up my sleeve, but I do love to observe, and I love to eat. And, yes, grocery stores are always good for that sort of thing. When my husband and I were in Mallorca doing research, I was in just, like, the ham aisle, and I just wrote down everything I saw. They have more kinds of ham than you could possibly imagine.
My husband found out that there's a ham museum in Barcelona, and he's like, that is now on the top of our list for when we travel again. We have a toddler.
Yeah.
And you have a son also, right?
I do, yeah. That was the one. I have an 11-month-old, and when we were in Mallorca doing research, I was pregnant, and so there were actually a lot of things that I couldn't eat, which is really sad. You know, I couldn't drink the wine, I couldn't eat the cured meats, I couldn't eat the unpasteurized cheeses.
Right.
It's really, really a bummer.
So how did you land on having Franny be a food writer?
It seemed like the right job for her. I wanted it to be something sensual and rich. You know, there are lots of books about writers, but that's sort of boring to me. I mean, you know, I'm a writer. God, that's boring. but someone whose job is to write and think about food is interesting to me, because, you know, that's sustenance, that's life. And it worked for me in terms of thinking about this woman who is sort of really wrestling with whether to hold her family together or let it shatter. Because for me, food is what keeps things together. You know, it's a way to punctuate the day. It's a way to come together. It's something to share with other people. And it worked. And also, it just meant that she was someone who I wanted to spend time with, because, you know, when she finds the jar of Nutella in the cabinet, she doesn't share it with everybody else. She just takes a spoon and just goes to town. Or not even a spoon. She uses her finger. She doesn't even use a spoon.
I love that scene, and that she hides it in a place that no one will look for it.
Right. Exactly.
And I think it's very indicative of the sort of where the family is at. Like, I feel like under any other circumstances, or 10 years ago, she would have shared that Nutella. You know, she would have made a point of, you know, putting it on toast. But because the family is falling apart, she is like, screw you guys, this is mine.
Absolutely.
And it's this, like, one very affordable little luxury that she gives herself to hide that jar of Nutella. I really liked that scene a lot.
Thank you.
So you live in Brooklyn, which has now become a place that people travel to in terms of looking for the next new food thing. What are some of your favorite places to eat in Brooklyn?
Well, one place that just opened that I'm really excited about, or two places that just opened that I'm excited about. Number one is Wilma Jean, which just opened on Smith Street at the folks behind Seersucker and Nightingale 9, Chef Rob Newton and his partner Carrie Diamond have just opened this fantastic fried chicken place, which is really unbeatable. There's some sort of a pimento cheese thing that you dip some tortilla chips in. It's out of sight, out of sight. And then my other new spot is the Meat Hook Sandwich Shop. Really so good. Just like sandwiches as big as your head and a little kooky crazy. Very inventive sandwiches and so, so good.
One of my favorite luxuries is to eat sandwiches that someone else made for me. Sandwiches are so easy that I rarely justify buying a sandwich, but when you have one that's made by someone else and they have all of the, like, just the right pickle and just the right lettuce and just the right everything, it's such a luxury.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So are you traveling this summer? Do you have food destinations lined up?
Well, I've been traveling around on my book tour, and of course, every time I go anywhere, it's an opportunity to eat. And so we went to the West Coast, my husband and my baby and I, and we got to San Francisco, and we got burritos immediately, of course.
Right.
We went to L.A., we got tacos immediately, of course.
Yeah, New York.
Very predictable, I guess.
Well, but New York just doesn't have the solid, that scene, and we have not worked out yet. We don't have a great burrito scene.
It's true. It's true. And then we went to Nashville, which my husband and baby and I were living in Nashville for 4 months this spring while I was teaching a class at Vanderbilt University. And so we acquired all of these favorites, and we were missing them. So we landed at about noon, and by my event, I had to be at my event at about 5 o'clock. And in those 5 hours, we had our favorite taco, our favorite fried chicken, our favorite juice, my favorite chocolate, our favorite ice cream.
I love that. Oh, we should hang out. I think we'd have fun.
When you don't have a lot of time, you really have to hit the ground running.
Right. Did you know where, like, were you on the plane? Like, okay, this is the most efficient way to make our way around these places.
Absolutely.
I love that. We should hang out. We would be good friends. My husband and I are like, we plan, like, okay, we're going to drive to Princeton, and we're going to go to this place for this and this place for that. We're going to stop at the Ben Spoon for ice cream on the way out of town. We do exactly the same thing. It's a wonderful, I have to say, as a food writer, it's a wonderful thing to focus on. To get to do research on food is pretty awesome.
And yeah, then I keep waiting. I keep hoping that, like, you know, Food and Wine or Bon Appetit or one of those places is going to read my book and be like, we really need to send this girl somewhere to eat lobster rolls or whatever. My fingers are crossed that somebody's going to, you know, give me a gig that I can't refuse.
Put it out there. Well, the Vacationers is kind of poised to have a sequel. You could always see where Franny goes next.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, unlike with short stories where, you know, you really sort of leave people in whatever moment they're in, you know, novels, I think usually, you know, you want them to feel totally, totally satisfying and like you never have to see those characters again. But I do feel like I want to keep up with these people and to see what happens next. Not because I know what happens. I don't know what happens next, but because I'm curious. Yeah, I'm curious, especially about Sylvia. You know, she's only 18. I can only imagine what she'll do for the rest of her life. I'm interested.
Emma Strauss, thank you so much for coming on Sharp and Hot. How can people find out more about you? What's your website?
Oh, there's too many ways for people to find out more about me. There's my website, which is emmastraub.net. There's Twitter at Emma Straub. There's Instagram at Emma Straub. There's Tumblr Emma Straub. There's Facebook. basically just everywhere. Everywhere on the internet is where I am.
Awesome. I'll be keeping up with you. Please come back when you publish your next work.
You got it. Thank you so much.
Have a great weekend.
Bye, you too.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Coming on Sharp and Hot.
Oh, my pleasure.
I hear you're familiar with Heritage Radio Network. That's wonderful to hear.
Yes. So, I've been out to Bushwick, and I've had the great pizza.
Excellent. Yes, we are known, Roberta's is known for their pizza, and I can attest to its deliciousness. So you are the New York Times bestselling author of Four Fish, and your new book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, is out now. And I am the daughter of a commercial fisherman, and my dad was a bayman, now he runs a farm stand. But I was wondering if we could focus on the oyster around New York Harbor, and I'll tell you that I live in a very old house, and when we first moved out here, my husband put a new patio down outside of the kitchen window. We're in Parsippany, New Jersey, and when he dug out the grass to put the fill in for the stones, we found discarded oyster shells from the mid-1700s, which was very cool.
Wow, amazing, yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can give me a little history of the oyster in New York and how it's sort of become the bellwether for the health of New York Harbor.
Yeah, so, well, oysters were at one time inextricably bound up with the identity of New York City. And it used to be, Mark Harlansky told me this once, that back in the day, you know, as recently as the 19th century, if you told somebody that you were going to New York, somebody would say to you, well, have a good time, enjoy the oysters. You know, sort of like, you know, when we go to the Gulf, you know, enjoy the crawfish or something like that. So New York is an estuary, to begin with, a place where the river meets the sea. And as such, it's a good place for oysters because oysters like to live on the margin between fresh and salt. And at one time, when settlers first came, they found wild oyster reefs and populations of oysters in the trillions. Some of those oysters would have been very old by comparison with, you know, your average oyster today, so 10, 15, 20 years old, and as big as dinner plates, it's been described. And Swift was quoted as saying once that eating an American oyster is like eating a baby because they're so large. But in any case, the Dutch first and then the English after them ate a lot of American oysters and pretty much mined out most of the wild reefs by around 1820. And after that, people started doing a primitive form of aquaculture where they would move seed oysters, you know, little oysters, from other beds into what had formerly contained wild beds. And they raised them and harvested them and sold them. When they ran out of seed in the New York area, they started transporting seed up from other places further out in Long Island Sound, and then eventually from the Chesapeake. And that industry continued to grow until about 1900 or so, up until about 1920, when New York, by the late 19th century, New York was putting in about 600 million gallons of raw sewage into the water every day. And a lot of oyster beds just got buried with the sheer amount of sewage. But also what it did was introduce things like cholera and hepatitis into the food supply. People didn't actually know what cholera was, or they didn't know what hepatitis was. They didn't know what caused these diseases until about the mid to late 19th century when they started doing, you know, bacterial biology and understanding that there was a direct connection between waste, oysters, and the disease. And at that point, by around the middle 1920s, people realized that oysters were making people sick, and the oyster industry pretty much stopped cold in New York. And then once we stopped looking at New York as a food system at all, that's when the really bad stuff started happening. So all of these post-war pollutants started getting dumped into the water, including dioxin residue from the manufacture of Agent Orange, produced over in New Jersey. And then, you know, just continued to decline and decline. And by 1972, when the Clean Water Act was passed, the oyster industry in this country was at 1% of historical capacity. So that's pretty much the modern history of the oyster.
It's just, it's incredible. And so you talk about the New York, New Jersey Baykeeper, and can you talk a little bit about the influence New Jersey's government has had on trying to recreate some oyster reefs in the wake of the recent hurricanes and what happened?
As I said, the advent of the Clean Water Act was the nadir for the New York oyster. And ever since then, as the water started to get cleaner, people have been thinking about oysters again. This history is kind of detailed in American Catch in the book, but so I won't go into too much detail here. But what I followed in particular was this coalition of organizations that was trying to put oysters back in the water starting in the early 2000s. New York Harbor is actually divided in ownership between New York and New Jersey. And at first, people like New York, New Jersey Baykeeper, Hudson River Foundation, they were all trying to do it on the New York side, but came up against significant regulatory issues. People were very worried about people eating these restored oysters and getting sick. So efforts were made in New Jersey because at the time, the New Jersey powers that be were much more receptive to the idea of oyster restoration. So most significantly was in Keyport Harbor. There was a restoration attempt made, and it was going really well. The oysters were really growing. But when the administration changed from the Corzine administration to the Christie administration, new people from the Department of Environmental Conservation came in and didn't like this idea of oysters at all, thought that they did pose a health risk, that people might poach them and eat them, and then demanded that Baykeeper remove the restored oysters and throw them in the garbage, which is what they did. So New Jersey got pretty much shut down, and now the situation is reversed, where the New York side is actually much more receptive to oyster restoration, and it's going gangbusters. In the last year, an institution called the New York Harbor School, which is a great high school out of Governor's Island, has launched a project called the Billion Oyster Project, with the goal of putting 1 billion oysters into New York Harbor, or the greater New York Bight, by 2035. And they've already got 1 million in the New York Bight, and it seems to be growing. So maybe Jersey will change their tune. There is actually one project going in New Jersey right now on the Naval Weapons Station Earl, not far from Keyport. It's a long, long pier, and it's protected by the military, so people figured it was safe to try and put some oysters off of the pier because nobody's going to try and poach them away from the U.S. Navy.
Is it too libertarian of me to say if somebody wanted to eat those oysters, let them and that problem will take care of itself? Like, let one person poach them and get really sick.
You know, that's one way of looking at it. You know, the people who are involved in oyster restoration are so gun-shy from regulators shutting them down that they would never say that. And I can understand them. I mean, it is really... they really got hit and hammered for doing this. You know, I do think it's a perversion of the law that this has happened. The legal premise by which the oysters were removed is something called attractive nuisance. And this is dates back from 19th century Industrial Revolution times. In those times, you know, factories, industry sites would leave all sorts of equipment out in their yards or on their grounds, and sometimes children would wander in, trip over a blade or, you know, play with something they shouldn't and would get very seriously hurt. And up until a certain point, families of those children wouldn't really have grounds, legal grounds, to sue the industrialists who had, you know, in effect hurt them. Well, eventually this legal argument was worked out called attractive nuisance, that, in other words, the thing on your property lured my child onto it, and cause them to endanger their lives. And to put the oyster within that context, to call it an attractive nuisance, I think is absurd, because, you know, the oyster was here in New York Harbor long before we were, and to say that it is the attractive nuisance and not we, to me, kind of convolutes things in an unnecessary way.
And not to give away too much of the story, because it really is an excellent read. You're a great storyteller. I really enjoyed your first book as well. You ate one of the oysters that you came upon with one of the students from the school, and you live to tell the tale. So maybe my theory isn't as sound as it, you know, initially sounds.
Well, no, I mean, as I've been out on tour, I've been saying, you know, I'm a professional writer. Don't try this at home. Don't eat the oyster. Now, you really shouldn't, and I almost did it kind of like as a professional dare to myself. But interestingly enough, that was up at Soundview in the Bronx. Not long after that, a guy from the Hudson River Foundation, who was also at the site, was just walking around and in waders, and he tripped, and an oyster cut into his waders and scraped him, and he got a horrible, horrible, horrible bacterial infection. So that's not even from eating anything. So, you know, let the eater beware. New York oysters really shouldn't be eaten under any circumstances. And if I did that, I did it with a kind of fear in my heart and ready to go to the hospital if I needed to.
Right. Well, maybe someday. Maybe someday as a result of your work.
But what's important, though, the lesson is, you know, and I had lots of backs and forths with my publisher on this. You know, she kept saying, well, why are we even writing about this if it's not seafood that you can eat? The thing is that in municipalities all over the East Coast, oyster grounds are getting taken offline all the time because we would prefer to have municipal wastewater systems that aren't really as efficient as they should be. We would prefer to have coastal development rather than working fishing communities. So what happened to New York is happening to other coastal communities and could happen to more if we don't value things like oysters and mussels and clams that we should be growing in our near shore.
Paul Greenberg, thank you so much for coming on Sharp and Hot. The book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. I can't wait to see what you write about next.
Thank you so much, Emily. Take care.
Thank you for listening, everybody. I will be back next week with Rob the Beekeeper. A very special thanks to Jack for engineering the show. And until next week, keep playing with fire and knives.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.